Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And we're listening to the HR Power Hour. And today our guest is Julia Rabinowitz. She is the Director of Policy, Operations, and Communication for the Maine Department of Labor. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
Good. You know, we haven't had you on in a little while.
No, it's been probably about 6 months, so
yeah. We've
had a few things happening over at the Department
say,
of Labor.
Nothing's happened in 6 months. Come on.
It's hard to imagine.
Well, you know, obviously, I think there is a lot to talk about. And so I'd like to start with actually an issue that employers are facing across the country, which is the workforce shortage and the tightening labor market,
especially
here in Maine. And so we have employers that are challenged really finding talent to cover a lot of their needs.
Yes.
You know, I was up at an event a couple weeks ago, and it was the hospitality group speaking to the universities about their needs, and they were having this conversation about that. One of the questions I asked the group, because I was moderating the group, was, do you feel that this year, 2016, you're going to be able to fill all your needs for your facilities to run them at peak operation all summer long? Not a hand went up.
No, and that's very problematic, not only because we need workers to fill these jobs, but as the economy has picked up, tourism has picked up, and so we have increasing numbers of tourists, so a need to even be able to staff up even more than previous years. It's a problem across a number of industries. And I think what's interesting is the contrast between the what we hear about the layoffs in the paper mill industry in particular. We've shed almost 2,000 jobs in the past 18 months in that industry. And people ask, why doesn't that affect the unemployment rate? Why is the unemployment rate still falling? And between December and February, our unemployment rate statewide fell 0.4 of a point. It's almost 0.5%. So we're seeing definitely a tightening. We've had some media reports characterize it as we're at full employment. And we don't really agree with that at the department in terms of looking at the labor markets themselves. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is that when we look at the unemployment rate that we usually talk about is called the U3. There's six levels
That's
of
right.
labor utilization. So we also want to look at what we call the U6. And that is everybody, and it's often referred to as the real unemployment rate.
Yeah, so that's the one that I quote most of the time. Because that is a real better reflection of what the real unemployment number
is. So when we take a look back to 2007, which was really our peak number of jobs in the state. We haven't recovered our pre-recessionary level of payroll jobs. So that's one thing to think about, that we, you know, is there room to grow in terms of our payroll, number of payroll jobs to reach our pre-recessionary levels? And we're not there yet. But at that point, when we had that largest number of payroll jobs, we in the state were at about an 8% labor utilization rate in the U6, and that was higher than the national U6 rate. And that U6 rate is a little problematic. It's a 12-month look back with quarterly averages, and it's updated every month. But it's not a month. It's not a snapshot in time the way we talk about the U3 rate.
It's a different metric.
Right. So it's always going to be lagging. But the U6 rate we have now is, although it's lower than the national rate, and we've talked a lot about nationally that there's been a lot of people who dropped out of the labor force. So we're lower, but we're still higher than we were in 2007. We're in the nines as opposed to being in the low eights. So we know that there's slack. There's people working part-time for economic reasons. There's people who have given up. And it may be regional. It may be that your paper mill did close and you live in an area of the state where there's not a lot of alternative employment for you. So you are working in a different industry than what you were trained in and doing a job that doesn't pay as much as you earned before, or only working part-time or not working at all. So it's hard to characterize the entire state. Certainly in Southern Maine, there's a lot more pressure in the labor market than there is in other parts of the state. Also on the coast, when you talk about hospitality in the summer where you need seasonal employment, and that's where we're starting to have some very serious discussions with employers as to what their alternative strategies are for workforce issues, for finding those workers, whether it's utilizing more retirees, more part-time, more flexible schedules, getting more young people into the labor force earlier. Those numbers have not returned to their pre-recessionary levels either, and that's an important avenue. But that's a challenge because as Maine students, more and more of them go on to college, their time is filled up with those activities in high school that make them more attractive for college and that squeezes out their ability to work.
Well, plus they also go back to college right at peak time. Right. Last couple of weeks of August, right during peak season, they're going back to college.
Yes.
It's a challenge on that.
So there's so many factors at play, but we're really thinking about how do we attract more workers to Maine. That's a big priority for this administration in terms of the governor's initiatives around student debt, bringing younger people in, forgiving their debt as a way to help them work here and reward them for staying here. And by the time they've stayed here for 5 or 6 years and helped pay off that debt, that maybe they've met someone and want to think about buying a house and getting married and starting a family in their late 20s. So that's the kind of thing that we do need. We need people who will settle here and raise children here and produce not only a workforce for the next 20 years, but for down the road.
You know, it's interesting because this goes right into the next topic, which talks about this tightening labor market, the issues with the minimum wage. And so, one of the challenges that was in this discussion point that I had with the hospitality group is that they talked about the challenge in finding basic labor. You know,
yes.
We're talking waitresses, waiters, laundry people, cleaners, housekeepers in this area. And there was some frank discussion amongst the owners in regards to some of the proposals out there for minimum wage, which they have simply said they cannot necessarily hire as many people if that wage goes up. What's the position of the Department of Labor in regards to this? Where are they coming down in regards to some of the proposals that are out there that may be on the ballot?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the 127th last year, so in the first session of the 127th legislature, the department opposed raising the minimum wage. And not because we don't want wages to rise, which I think sometimes it's been characterized as, but because of this naturally tightening labor market due to supply and demand, we're seeing wages go up. I mean, one of the reasons why Portland picked 10-10 was because they believed that very few people were making less than 10 in Portland and it wouldn't be much of an enforcement issue. And that's really true. Southern Maine, the starting wages in your service industry and hospitality industries are in the $10 an hour range. Now, that's not necessarily the case in the rest of the state, but the rest of the state can't support a $12 an hour minimum wage 4 years from now. So, and we don't know what kind of recession it's going to hit or when a recession may hit, you know, God forbid, in the next few years.
But it will, because let's be honest.
The business cycle can't go on forever.
That's exactly right.
So how do we address those natural wage fluctuations and get people with skills? Because as the department argued, wages are the proxy for the value of the skills that you bring to the job. And if you're in an entry-level job and you have very few skills, you're going to earn the lowest wage. And as you bring more skills and gain more skills, you tend to move up the ladder. There's very, very few workers in Maine who are making minimum wage at 40 hours a week and never getting a raise. It's not like you're stuck there at minimum wage. You should be gaining skills the longer you're employed. And if, as the Department of Labor, we're saying you're not getting a raise in this labor market, you shouldn't be staying with that employer because you can take your skills and get a job with someone who's going to pay you what you're worth.
There is this, as you just mentioned before, where you live issue. And if you're, you know, yes, in southern Maine versus northern Maine, and I know it's cliche to say the two Maines.
Right.
But there is some truth to it, irregardless
right.
of
and
the
it's more, and it may be more so the coast in the I-95
correct.
Corridor.
In the, yep. in the other yep. area. So we have this issue of the minimum wage. We then have the issue of we're getting ready to get the rulings at some point here in regards to salaried employees or exempt
yes, a
employees.
Huge issue, okay. which I think people who are talking about the minimum wage aren't realizing the squeeze on the other end.
That's exactly right. So you've got this real double barrel hit that could happen in 2016 where salaries have to go up if, in fact, you leave them salary or if you just make them hourly.
Right.
Which issues with overtime, right?
Oh,
in terms
yeah.
of that, right?
Yep.
And you've got this issue with the minimum wage. And, you know, I'll mention it only because I know that it's potentially on the ballot, is this income increase that if you make over $200,000, you get another tax on top of that for another 2 or 3%.
Right.
So,
which is it hurts your pass-through entities.
Exactly
small
correct.
Businesses.
Small businesses, LLCs,
yep.
S-corps, or any
yep.
of that simple area. So, you know, there's an awful lot coming at business right now from that aspect. And, you know, we're trying to be open for business. So, you know, talk to us about where you see all this coming together and could this create a recessionary issue?
Well, you know, the minimum wage will take a few years to work its way up to having a more significant impact. So if it goes from $7.50 to $8.50 in the next year on January 1, you know, that will be impactful for a handful of businesses, but I don't think it's going to force multiple businesses to close. It's the continuous upward pressure of that to the 12, which is when you're ranked 46th in wages, though nationally, which is where Maine is, when you are pushing wages up artificially, that's a huge leap up the scale for us. I think the overtime issue, the immediacy of that, we don't know what the implementation schedule is going to be from USDOL. We believe we're going to get those rules in June, and then we will know a lot more about that. But it's likely that they would go into effect for January 1, 2017. That's going to double the cost of your salaried employees for anyone who's making in the lower range of that salary level. And that also has, as it was initially proposed, an indexing to the CPI, which means you're giving raises to all your salaried workers every year. And it's not just the effect it has on companies. Think about the effect that it has on your municipal budget. With all the salaried workers who work for your town. So you take your salaried workers and you make them overtime eligible, but then you limit their hours to 39 a week so that you don't pay any overtime.
Right.
And that has a huge ripple effect because you're taking a worker who had a certain flexibility by virtue of being exempt and on salary to work more one day and less another day and leave early to take a class or to pick up a child or to go to the school play or all those other kinds of things that impact that life-work balance. And now they're on the clock for that.
Well, there is a status of being a salaried employee, which allows you the flexibility to do things that you not necessarily can do as an hourly employee. And, you know, this really does change some of that, especially at the mid-level range,
right?
So retail management.
It's going to have a huge impact.
Restaurant management. In your
workers who are covering shifts and the way that they have structured that rule in the initial proposal, if you're spending more than 50% of your time doing the overtime eligible work, so say someone calls out sick for 3 days because they have the flu, and now you, as the assistant manager, are working the cash register or you're doing the hostessing job or whatever, 50% of your time that week. So now suddenly you're overtime eligible. I mean, the record-keeping burden for these businesses is going to be outrageous trying to track that. And then the cost of that on top of all of the other things that these businesses are getting thrown at them right now.
We're talking with Julie Rabinowitz, Director of Policy Operations and Communications for the Maine Department of Labor. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB and now on 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're talking with Julie Rabinowitz. She is the Director of Policy, Operations, and Communication from the Maine Department of Labor. And we're talking about all the wonderful things that are happening in the labor market today. We've talked a little bit about the minimum wage. We talked a little about some of the overtime rules that may be changing here in the next few months. And we've talked a little bit about the tightening labor market. I want to stay with this topic for just a little bit longer, if we could, in terms of the tightening labor market. You know, it's interesting. We're trying to attract talent to the state of Maine.
Yes.
Right? And so what have you seen from the Department of Labor that is helping attract talent that you can say, hey, here's some programs that we're promoting Maine? Have you been working with the Department of Tourism? What are some of the promotion
areas? We've begun those conversations. It's really something that is beyond just the scope of the department. Most of our funding is federal, but the programs are internally focused, both by state law and federal law. The Department of Economic and Community Development is really where the business attraction piece comes in, and they do have the Office of Tourism. Our aging population and our shrinking workforce are an issue not only for businesses in terms of workforce, but also when we think about tourism, about your internal clientele patronage, you know, restaurants, who's going out to dinner and bringing the kids along, family entertainment. So there's a tourism component for the staycation, people from Maine vacationing in Maine. And so attracting people from out of state who can grow our population is also a priority there. So we're looking at those kinds of things. One thing that the department is launching this summer will be a new job board to replace the Maine Job Bank. And we are mandated to have a job board. A lot of businesses say, why are you competing with the private sector? Well, the feds mandate that we have a job board, and it really replaced the old job registration system for the unemployment when you were visiting the unemployment center in person every week and filing for unemployment and talking with the jobs counselor and showing where you were, and they were referring you to open positions. The job bank really replaced that system. The new job link, we call it, will be part of a consortium of 15 other states where the core federal requirements are the center of the technology, and then there's customized front ends for each of the states. So it's cheaper for the state to maintain, which is a good thing.
That's great.
But it also can be modernized efficiently and effectively and kept up to date with technology. That will connect us to more national jobs and promote Maine jobs nationally, where our job bank now is not fully integrated with the national job board database and with all the other states. And that will be one avenue that we'll use to recruit more people from out of state. But it really is also the responsibility of individual businesses, and this is something that the commissioner really focuses on and talks about, to understand how to recruit in this kind of job market. And that she spoke at the tourism conference a few weeks ago, and she said, you know, you just can't open up in April and put a help wanted sign and an ad in the paper and think that you're going to get enough workers to staff your facility, going back to the hospitality industry. You need to start recruiting in December. You need to think about what the other options are, foreign workers, H-2A, H-2B, and the J-1 visa program, and really think about how you use all those programs to supplement your workforce. And also thinking about internships and recruiting young people from colleges and other places to come work here in the summer, or all kinds of things. Thinking, we need to think outside the box about promoting Maine and recruiting people to work here, and particularly younger people who will want to stay.
You know, it's interesting, again, at this event I was at, we talked a little bit about a lot of workers who have skills that may not be tailored for today's market. And there was a lot of discussion about money available, and there's a lot of money available to retrain workers today.
Yes.
And there's a discussion about that actually it's one of the highest amounts that we've seen in a while that's available. Are you seeing employers really understanding that and using it to its maximum potential?
I think the healthcare industry is leading the way in understanding the value of partnering with state agencies and doing that public-private partnership to do that training. We're also seeing that really take hold in manufacturing in certain corridors where we've developed those relationships over time. Somewhat in the marine trades, boat building is another example where we've to have some longer-term partnerships that are starting to pay off. But more and more employers need to think about what are those entry-level job skills that they need, and is there a short-term way of bringing a candidate up to speed so that they're bringing a lot more value as an employee, and how do they partner with these training providers, whether it's accessing federal training dollars that we have through apprenticeship, and other training programs at the Department of Labor or the community colleges or adult ed. There's no wrong door, but think about what kind of course. Maybe it's 3 weeks. Maybe it's 20 hours a week for 3 weeks. Maybe it's 40 hours a week for 5 weeks that get a worker ready to become your employee. And we don't have to guarantee that you hire that individual. What we want to do is guarantee that they get an interview and perhaps get an interview with multiple employers, ideally.
Yeah, I think that's really a striking example of how a good partnership works between state and private employers.
Yes.
And I'm not sure that employers truly fully understand that as much. And I know that it's being talked about. I know
right.
It's out there. But I use the example of the groups that I go to and we talk about these things. There really is not a complete understanding of it. And so that's probably an area where if as I think about it, that could be really a good area to continue to talk
about.
Yeah,
and we actually are using part of our most recent federal grant for job training to do some marketing and public relations. The feds make us call it outreach, but that's really what it is marketing public relations to promote this and make this a higher profile so that employers can understand. And really what we want is a pool of employers from a region or even statewide, but that have very specific needs. We can do it depending on how many workers an industry or a business needs to hire. We can run a class for 15 people for five businesses or 20 people for one business. We can do it for CNAs. We can do it for construction. We can do it for precision manufacturing. We could do it for IT in terms of the coding classes that you can take online. But it's really recruiting a pool of candidates, identifying who qualifies for which funding stream, and if the employer puts in a little money, and the feds in the state and all our grants, we put in a little money, and the community college or the training provider puts in a little money, we can get everyone in that class covered so they're not paying out of pocket to get that certification or degree.
No, I think that's great. I think that's an area that, again, needs to be talked more about,
yes.
Right, within,
yes.
within the state and the organization. One of the questions that I got asked, and I didn't have an answer for, had to do with the career centers.
Yes.
And so certainly during the times when we had a lot of people unemployed, the career centers were very, very busy. We know that,
yes.
Right?
Yep.
No question. So, you know, I got asked the question. I thought I'd ask it on the air. What exactly are we doing with the career centers today? What's their main focus? Because they're not seeing the volumes that we're seeing today.
Right. So I think first we start with the fact that unemployment claims are down to a 31-year low. Now, we have a falling unemployment rate, but we also have fewer people collecting unemployment, and the folks who are collecting it are tending to collect it for a shorter period of time. And that's because there's so many jobs available.
Absolutely.
So career centers are still seeing individuals come in because there's always job loss. We have the mill closures. The northern part of the state, those career centers, Bangor, Skowhegan, Wilton, to a certain extent, Lewiston, because they're close to Jay with Verso's layoff, are seeing an influx of candidates who are looking for the retraining because of those programs. But most of the clients that we're receiving are people who have a few more barriers to employment. So as the labor market gets tighter, the more skilled candidates tend to not be unemployed or can find a job very quickly if they are laid off or lose their job. The folks that we're serving, we have a little more time to treat their needs more intensively and work with them to get them the training that they need and get them to the place where they need to be. We also have our vocational rehabilitation program working with people who have particular disabilities that present a barrier to employment, and so we can train them. And I think that's an avenue that a lot of employers don't, you know, you say disability and they think ADA and discrimination, the potential for a lawsuit. But if you can tailor a position for a particular employee who has needs a certain kind of accommodation, obviously if they're in a wheelchair, your building needs to be ramp accessible, but whatever it is that their accommodation needs, they're going to be very loyal employees because you made the effort to accommodate them, and they can't as easily find another employer who's willing to make that accommodation. So not that I'm saying they're a captive employee, because that's certainly not the case, but they tend to be appreciative of the effort that the employers put out. And they can be very, very valuable. And a lot of employers, I think, underestimate how simple some and how inexpensive some of the accommodations can really be. So the career centers are really doing a lot of that work with the clients who are coming in, but they're also doing a lot more employer outreach and talking about employers and trying to connect employers with these training programs, setting up these training programs. And we are partnering with DHHS to help some of the folks who are being transitioned off of welfare and the FSEP program in particular. So there's a lot of work going on. And job fairs, we're running a ton of job fairs. Employer recruitments are down, I think, because employers know that the career center traffic is likely down, and also because they're participating in these job fairs.
I think you're right. That's
several
true.
Of them yeah. are doing, several of the career centers are doing monthly or bi-monthly job fairs, so the employers are participating in those.
Great. So we're talking with Julie Rabinowitz, Director of Policy Operations and Communications for the Maine Department of Labor. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLLB, and now on 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're having the pleasure of speaking with Julie Rabinowitz, Director of Policy Operations Communication for the Maine Department of Labor. It's great.
It's always good to come talk to you.
It's always good to get an update. It's always good. So switching gears a little bit here and talking about the legislative session, there was a bill that happened in regards to changes in the severance pay law. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So that bill was a carryover from the first session, and that was a department bill. And our goal with changing the severance pay statute really stemmed out of what we learned about the enforcing the existing statute in these large mill layoffs, and particularly Bucksport. And the old version, which, so this version passed and it'll become law 90 days after the end of the session. So we're looking at sometime in July, this law will become in effect with the new thresholds in the severance pay law. The old law required that the department look at a stoppage of work for any facility that employed more than 100 employees commercially in the state of Maine. And I'll get into the stoppage of work issue also when we talk about the other bill that the department sponsored this session. But we don't want to look at stoppage of work, because really what stoppage of work means is we have to look at the operations of a business. So in the case of Verso Bucksport, they closed and everyone was laid off. So obviously work was stopped. And it was about substantial cessation of operations was the terminology that's in that statute. Yep. So when we look at Verso J, they lay off 300 of 800 employees. Is that substantial cessation of operations? What line did they shut down? How much productivity did that line have? What were the jobs of the individuals who were laid off as? That means the Department of Labor is getting up in your stuff as an employer to make a determination as to whether or not the employees are due severance pay. And the lawyers like it because that means they can just fight it in court and let a judge decide. It's burdensome for the department, and we did not want to be involved in that. So what we proposed was changing the threshold to meet the standards of the WARN Act. And that gives clear numbers for employers to understand if you lay off X number of employees in this time frame or X percentage of your workforce within this time frame, you will be required to pay severance or you won't. And granted, there's always loopholes with this where employers can look at the numbers and figure out a time frame in which they do the layoffs, and then they're not responsible for severance pay. But that happened under the other law, too.
Well,
so
yeah.
There's pluses and minuses, and this is such a touchy area. We negotiated with the interested parties. We talked to AFL-CIO, the Machinists Union. We talked to the state chamber and attorneys who represent employers and really tried to get this down. The other major change in that bill allows the department to file for severance, a petition for severance, when there's a bankruptcy filing. So in the case of Verso Bucksport, they did not file for bankruptcy before announcing the layoff. In the case of Verso J, they laid off 300 workers, for example, but we couldn't prove substantial cessation of operations, so there was no severance pay requirement there. And then they filed for bankruptcy. So if they lay off more workers, they are grandfathered under the old statute where any more layoffs, if they could lay off all 500 tomorrow, and none of them would be eligible for severance pay because they filed a petition for bankruptcy. We've eliminated that. That was something the governor wanted to eliminate, and the department felt it doesn't guarantee that any of those workers are going to get severance pay. And under the bankruptcy code, the payout for back wages, final vacation pay, and any severance pay could not total more than about $12,500 per employee. So when you get into those situations, there's going to be back vacation pay paid out, all those things. So it's not meaning that an employer is going to have this unlimited amount of pay.
Right.
And the other thing we learned through this process was that in the rules under the severance pay statute, under the old rules, there was a provision that had a look back, that you, the employer, were responsible, even though you only own the company for 4 years, for as long as that employee worked at that facility. So if the business had been sold, you were still liable for a 30-year look back if that worker was there. We actually determined that that conflicted, A, with another part of the statute that limited the liability to 3 years. And secondly, the rules exceeded the authority of the statute. That wasn't even in the law, that look back period.
Of course it wasn't.
But they wrote it into the rules, and they were major substantive, so they had to go through the legislature to get that stuff written into the rules. And that is gone. There's not going to be a look back like that. It was never enforceable. But that's gone away. So I think it's going to be clear going forward who is going to fall under this.
Well, it's great that provision. We're going to have some clarity on it, right? Because I think most employers understand the Warren Act. So, you know, from that aspect, it makes it much simpler
yes,
to understand.
Yes, it's more consistent
exactly. with across the exactly. you know federal and state and all
totally.
That. So it makes perfect sense. There's another bill.
So let's talk about our bill. LD-1501 was a bill that was a department-sponsored bill that we introduced this year, and this also addressed the issue of work stoppage, except in the instance of unemployment during labor disputes.
Right.
So state law was modified for 50 years. Maine had a law that said if you're striking voluntarily for financial reasons. Not for health and safety, not being locked out, but if you're striking voluntarily because your contract and you stand to gain in your contract, you can't get benefits while you're on strike. And there was a change made in the law about 20 years ago, and they took text from a Kansas law, one sentence, and put it in the Maine law. The Maine law then had a summary. It was so confusing because what it caused was our unemployment appeals system to delve in once again to figure out, was there a work stoppage, meaning what percentage of production had stopped while this labor dispute went on, and also required the employer, also required benefits if the employer hired temporary workers. Well, in the statute, it didn't actually say what that meant, but the summary of the bill really went beyond what the scope of the law was. And it was so convoluted that the courts have looked to the summary to figure out what the law was supposed to mean. And it's just ended up being a huge case. And we have had instances where workers have gone on strike and the department has had to pay out millions of dollars, depending on the length of the strike and the number of the workers, of unemployment benefits to people who actually voluntarily left to strike and didn't lose their job. And by the time the appeals process goes through, because usually what happens is there's a strike and the benefits are denied because it's within a week or two people begin filing and the department has to make a decision. And we don't know the extent of the work stoppage. We don't know the temporary workers. So all these decisions get made up front and then you appeal.
That's right.
And then this investigation has to take place about everything that happened after the decision was made. And we don't want to be in that position. So, of course, this bill failed, but we will be back at it again because we think that getting the department out of making those decisions and having clear-cut rules both protects the trust fund and really does not force all the employers in the state to subsidize one business's striking workers in their labor dispute. And they might be a very bad employer, but the other employers shouldn't be forced to subsidize a bad employer.
Well, it's good that we know that it's coming back. We know that.
We're always – the Page administration brings the good ones back, even if they are going to die again.
Well, you know, it's consistency. Consistency.
Right, right.
In terms of – you know, the other issue that we can talk about is the controversy that happened with the fallout from workers and businesses in regards to the Unemployment Insurance Commission appointment.
Yes.
So I'll let you talk about it.
All right. The – Unemployment Insurance Commission is a panel of three commissioners. They are full-time employees. They are not employees of the Department of Labor. They're kind of separate and apart, although their funding comes through the Department of Labor's Bureau of Unemployment Compensation, and it's a federal fund that the department gets, and then we use some of that money to fund the UIC. But the Unemployment Insurance Commission reports to the governor. Those commissioners do not report to the Commissioner of Labor. They sit outside the department. And they hear appeals. Now, they hear most things they hear are appeals that come from the Division of Administrative Hearings, which is inside the Department of Labor. But some things have original jurisdiction at the Unemployment Insurance Commission level, including tax cases. Now, we actually found out in the past year in researching all this that tax cases are not supposed to be heard by the commission. They have to be heard within the department at the division first. So that's another bill we'll be putting in, and that should be beneficial for employers.
Absolutely.
But there's a few rules in the statute surrounding the Unemployment Insurance Commission, and it's one of the older boards and commissions in terms of state government. So it's very loosely written, and it hasn't really been updated in several years, or in decades, I should say. But they need a quorum to hold hearings and to make certain decisions.
That would be two out of three.
Yes. And two of the three retired a couple months apart in 2015, leaving two vacancies. And the governor's office has the governor has the authority to make these appointments. They had a few candidates be suggested to them, and they had a vetting process. And they identified a candidate, Steve Webster of Westbrook, who's a policeman but has been president of the Maine Police Association of Police Union, hearing grievances, working on behalf of employees, and they determined that they wanted to appoint him to be the employee rep. There's an employee rep, an employer rep, and then the chair who represents the people. The chair has to be an attorney. So the chair is currently not vacant. Jen Duddy is the chair, Jennifer Duddy, but the other two, employer and employee rep. And they're not there to vote only for that person. Right. They're there to make sure that the perspective of that claimant, the employee or the employer, is heard in full, and that the case record is fully and fairly developed. There was a lot of partisanship at the confirmation hearing, and the Democrats voted against Steve Webster's nomination. So what I really want to talk about is then the fallout for that, because as I mentioned, there's some things that can only be heard at the commission level. So we have four types of cases that really have to be heard at the commission level. One is the tax cases that I just mentioned. We don't get a lot of those a year because the Employer Services Division of Unemployment really tries to resolve those. But an employer does have the right to appeal, and sometimes that appeal is precedent setting for other businesses in that industry. So it's important that that appeal be heard. We cannot hear those appeals until we get another commissioner, and that could be at least 6 months to a year. So all those tax cases will be on indefinite hold.
Yeah.
Those could involve worker misclassification. Those could involve the organizational structure, whether they were covered in paying unemployment and they didn't need to be, all kinds of different things. The only positive thing I can say about that is that the interest won't accrue while those cases are on hold for the tax employers. Another type of case, and they get the most of these type of cases, are overpayment waiver requests where claimants were paid unemployment and then later it was determined that they weren't eligible. Now, fraud cases can't be waived. So if you had someone collecting unemployment,
that makes perfect sense, of course.
Fraudulently, we're not going to waive that. But if you had a case where someone filed for unemployment, they were awarded unemployment, the employer appealed, it got flipped on the appeal, and then that individual had been paid benefits for the 5 or 6 weeks while they were waiting to get the appeal done, now they have to pay that money back. Those are the kinds of cases where they're appealing for a waiver because they're saying, I don't have a job, I don't have any way to pay this back. And we have 182 of those pending since October. Those are big cases filed since October. And they can also be held for a year. And those will continue to accrue. So we could end up with a few hundred or several hundred of those cases by the time another person gets appointed.
They're going to be very busy when they get on that
board. Yes, they will. and then there's also some cases where we do income tax offsets from state income tax for money that you owe the department due to an overpayment issue. Some of those could be employer where the employers have owed. And then also the lottery tax offsets. So because we can seize your lottery winnings if you have to, not a payment of $50 that you get at the convenience store where you bought your ticket, but anything over $1,000 where you have to get it paid through the lottery board. Those are cross-matched against people who owe us money. And those seizures are appealable to the commission. So all those cases are on hold. We are notifying everyone who's currently filed that there are cases on indefinite hold, and then we will continue to do so. But it's going to be problematic for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's unfortunate that it became political, right? It's just unfortunate. But I suppose not surprising in today's environment.
It's difficult. And that board has been controversial. People raised issues of the luncheon that the governor had with the hearing officers that actually resulted in a lot of positive reforms and improvements in the system that have benefited both claimants and employers. And no bias has been found in any audits that the USDOL has done, and they've stopped doing special audits because there wasn't any justification for them. So we know at the department that we're implementing good processes and that we've implemented the precedent committee where the three sitting commissioners work with all the other folks in the department to make sure that unemployment decisions are following protocol, procedure, and case law.
Sure.
So we've improved those things, but despite all of that, these cases will be on hold.
Sure. Well, we're talking with Julie Rabinowitz. She's the Director of Policy Operations and Communication with the Maine Department of Labor. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB and now on 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAKorea.com. And today we've been talking with Julie Rabinowitz, Director of Policy, Operations, and Communication, and a very, very long title for the Maine Department of Labor.
Go.
How's that?
Excellent.
That's very, very good. Your title's changed multiple times.
Well, I keep on taking on additional
I know.
Roles.
You keep on having more things, more commas.
Yes.
It's great. You know, it's great. You do a great job
thank
there. It's
you,
fabulous.
Thank you.
So the last thing I want to talk about today is the changes that are coming up with the drug testing program.
Right. And we put together a work group. We introduced a bill in the last legislature in the spring of 2015, and it got carried over to 2016. And we were asked, because we wanted to make changes to the drug testing law. We're an outlier. Our drug testing law is unlike any other in the country. We have a lot of requirements on employers. We don't allow employers to do random testing if you have fewer than 50 employees, which our drug testing information we've gathered from employers shows that random testing is the best deterrent for drug use. We saw no increase last year statistically in positive drug tests from the random testing employers, and every other category drug testing increased, and we're now at record levels of positives, except in random testing. But we don't want to change the law to allow more employers to do the one thing that actually deters people from being impaired at work. But we were asked to look at not only at the changes that we had proposed, but also to work with employers to try to look at the issue of legalized medical marijuana, as well as prescription drugs, so substances that people are authorized to take legally but may have issues on the drug test because in the case of marijuana, you can pop positive but not be impaired.
Right.
And some medical marijuana doesn't have an impairment aspect to it, but you still would pop positive for it. There's so many variations in the medical marijuana issue, as well as prescription drugs, including opiates, that could impair you on the job, and the issue of the potential of legalized marijuana. And Colorado and Washington State are watching Maine very carefully, because we developed, as part of this working group, we were the first state to really look at this issue and try to come up with an alternative mechanism to address legal use of impairing substances that a drug test won't solve for the employer. Are they okay to work?
Right. What's the impact overall?
So we issued a report in the winter. It was like the end of January, early February, where we really looked at this issue, and I encourage employers to take a look at it. We have made recommendations for a program that would be the first of its kind in the nation, and it was opposed by the unions. We were just talking about union opposition and the Unemployment Insurance Commission. An alternative bill was introduced. It wouldn't solve the problem the way that this working group and the department. We had more than 50 people involved in that working group.
And you had all sides with that.
We met all summer long. We had industry representation, employer representation, individual businesses, as well as trade groups. HR professionals were very involved in that. People who do drug testing, insurance companies.
The medical marijuana was very
Highly involved in that, because it's something that protects their clients as well. It's looking at the intersection of the ADA, Maine Human Rights Law, the federal drug laws, the federal drug testing laws, the state drug testing laws, and the medical marijuana law. So we will be back at it again. We actually will be hosting a conference this year in Maine of the other commissioner of labors and directors of bureaus, such as our Bureau of Labor Standards, Wage and Hour, and Workplace Safety folks. And we will be presenting these findings to them, and we will continue to work with this. A lot of it depends on whether or not legalized marijuana comes into the state, and that will have huge ramifications. There are businesses leaving Colorado because their workers are higher all the time.
Yeah, I know it's a big issue, and it's from an impairment standpoint that the problem is, you know, what people do is their own business. But when you're at the workplace, it's everybody's business.
Right.
It's safety first.
And it's safety for all the coworkers, which is why we were very disappointed that the unions were not active participants in the work group. They only went to one session after the first final draft of the recommendation came out, when we would have liked to have had them there, and they were invited and aware of all of those other meetings.
Well, we've been talking with Julia Rabinowitz from the Department of Labor. You've done a great job explaining an update to us. You're always welcome back.
Thank you.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and now on 100.5 FM. Next week on the HR Power Hour, Tom Dowd is going to be joining us. You know him for his past five books. Well, he has a sixth one that is hitting the market, and it's called Now What? The Ultimate Graduation Gift for Professional Success. We can't wait to talk to him about it, and he'll be here next week on the HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.